This week, a closer look at what Eli Manning is, what Eli Manning was, and the New York Giants rebuild. Or is it a rebuild? We're not really sure, but we're going to see if we can figure it out on the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. And Andy, I'm glad you're here today because I've had something that I've been meaning to talk to you about, and that is Eli Manning and the Giants.
Oh, good. So we're going to talk at length about that because that's also the subject of the email you sent about the show's outline earlier today.
That's why you shouldn't have been surprised by the whole thing. But yeah, we're going to talk a little bit of Eli because this has been a, let's call it a confusing offseason for the New York Giants. And I think people are sort of looking to sort of catch their footing with what this team is doing. And I don't know if we'll have a legitimate explanation, but we're going to sort of explore not only the Giants, but sort of more generally where a team in this spot might, what direction they might want to go in at this point.
Yeah, and I think that's the way to do it because if we're just talking Eli Manning specific, that's going to be kind of a limited show. But what's interesting about the Giants overall is it gets into a lot of philosophy about what does it mean to rebuild? How do you rebuild in the NFL? And I think that is an interesting conversation, most certainly.
And obviously, we're going to jump off by doing exactly what we just said we were not going to do. We're going to talk about Eli for just a couple minutes here because he's something of a fascinating case. I'm going to rewind back to this time last season when we were kind of bullish on the Giants. We liked what they had built as far as the skill positions go. It turns out they were bad in the trenches, bad offensive line, no pass rush. But Eli did not hold up well behind that line. And I guess it's just time to kind of look at, you know, he had a decent second half of the year that if you squint, you could be optimistic. But I don't know. This seems like a guy, he seemed a little shell-shocked last year, I guess is how I would describe it.
Well, you always have the factor of his bizarre, perplexed facial facial comportment that makes him look like he's thinking. So, I mean, that's like he never looked like a leader until he won a Super Bowl because his face had that "what am I doing? Where am I?" look on it all the time. So he seems shell shocked because when something goes wrong, he looks like a shell shocked man. I think what Eli Manning is at this point, Gary, because we need to agree on what he is, or at least establish for listeners what we each think he is. I think he is a very serviceable, high-level game-managing type of QB, and I mean that in a positive way. I think he can control a game at the line of scrimmage where he's not good anymore, and he's probably never been great at it, but he has been explicitly bad lately, is when there are bodies around him in the pocket. And that's a problem in the NFL. You have to be able to function when that happens. I don't think it's a toughness issue with Manning. It's not a toughness issue. He not only will stand tall in the pocket, but he knows how to protect himself and twist his body and take all kinds of hits safely. I think it's just a decision-making issue. He can be a little bit reckless. So when the offense around him isn't functioning well, he has to lift them up mentally and get them in and out of the right plays and get them winning before the snap because he can't be counted on to consistently raise them up after the snap.
Well, I thought my biggest criticism of his play last year was the ball was just coming out too early. He wasn't giving a chance for anything to develop downfield, and I think that's what was most discouraging about that offense last year. The offensive line is bad, you know, that's just the way it goes sometimes, but he didn't really give him a chance to deliver these big plays.
Well, that's what happens when you don't trust your offensive line, when a quarterback starts getting antsy and playing impatiently, and the value of a good offensive line, there's twofold there. One is you get the protection and your plays function well, but two is you get the insurance policy where the people executing the plays believe they will function well, and they believe they'll give it time to unfold, and Manning will move within the pocket rather than look to get the ball out quickly. And if you're not believing in your offensive line, then you don't get that second part, that second benefit there, and that impacts quarterbacks, play callers, might even impact wide receivers in certain cases. So it was, which is why the Zeitler trade, Kevin Zeitler from the Browns a few weeks ago, that was a valuable move for the Giants because You don't need to be great in the NFL along the offensive line, especially when you have Eli Manning at QB, who will generally get the ball out quickly, but you got to be good enough, because you've got to give them a clean pocket and you've got to let everyone believe the offense can function. And that doesn't happen if you have to hide or play around your offensive line.
I do. As we all kind of sit back in awe that the Giants are giving him another year, or at least that's the general perception, and I realize I'm up here in the New York area where everything's a little bit amplified as far as the reaction to everything the Giants do, but it's just, I guess you look back on Eli's career, there's this sort of revisionist history that because he won the two Super Bowls, that at some point he was a superstar quarterback.
Yeah.
That he was a great quarterback. You know, he was on par with a Rivers or a Roethlisberger or these guys. Obviously, he's beaten Brady twice in a Super Bowl. But I mean, that kind of wasn't what he is. If you take away the Super Bowl factor that makes a sort of inflate guys' legacy and sort of embellishes their what they were in our memories. This is probably where you thought 38-year-old Eli Manning would be at this point.
Yeah, that's probably fair. Remember that? I remember when I went to NFL Films for the first time and I was young and I was saying, oh, Manning's a superstar. And somebody in that room, I remember who it was, but I don't know if they'd appreciate me saying who it was. But they said back, well, the Giants basically played around him in that Super Bowl. They had just won it a year and a half ago. The Giants won with their defense. They played around him. It was a low-scoring slugfest game, and Manning made two or three big plays down the stretch that made it look like he was great. But the game lasts 70 plays. It's a 70-play game. And that was the view of Manning within the NFL. I don't think anyone in the league... I know I had a head coach say to me last year that it's not even a discussion about Roethlisberger, Rivers, and Manning, where Manning ranks in that trio. I don't know if he's a distant third, but he's a firm third. And I think if you polled people around the NFL, and we're talking the breadth of Manning's career now, the league doesn't look at Super Bowl rings in the same awe that outsiders do. And because they're not watching this through the Disney movie prism, where it's at the end of the day, the guy dug in, found something great, and carried him to a Super Bowl. They realize there's a lot more than just the quarterback that goes into the Super Bowl. And so most people in the NFL, a vast majority, would tell you, yeah, that's important that Manning's got the rings, but that doesn't define him. That doesn't make him better than Phillip Rivers, who is clearly the more effective all-around quarterback when you look at the scope of their careers. And Roethlisberger's in the Rivers class.
I want to relay a quick two-part story about Eli. This is from I talked to Jarvis Green a couple years ago for a big SI Super Bowl 50
is that
book project.
Jarvis Green, the D lineman, is that who that?
For the Patriots.
Yeah.
For the Patriots.
Yep.
So we were talking about that game. We're talking about Super Bowl 42, and obviously he was in on the helmet catch play. He was one of the guys who had Eli in his grasp, and Eli came away. And one thing he said, his one takeaway from that play was, obviously they watched so much film on Eli, and they knew Eli in and out. And he said, Eli would have never gotten away in a regular season game if that had happened. He's a guy who would, you hate to say give himself up, but he's not a guy who would fight through that and make that play. But the other part of that story, which is not so much about Eli, but I just found it really entertaining, so I will relay it anyway. Jarvis Green, after that game, he's so hurt. He said he went out of his way to not watch anything on sports. He didn't watch any basketball games, anything like that. He didn't want to come across anything from that Super Bowl. And he started getting checks at his house. And he didn't know what it was from, so he called the NFLPA and said, why am I getting these like $15 checks every day? And the NFLPA said, oh, you're in a Gatorade commercial. You're the guy that Eli Manning escapes from, and so you get royalty checks for that. And they asked him, do you want us to stop the checks? And he said, no, but...
that's a principled stand he took then. That's a real principle. You know, his first point, the reason I said you're right about it, because that's interesting that he said Manning would not have extended that play in the regular season. He's probably right. I had a conversation with Manning in the preseason this year about QBs protecting themselves. And like almost every other starter in the league, which I never would have guessed would be the case, but he said, yeah, you've got to know when to fight to live, or you live to fight another day.
Yeah.
But when I also think Mike Carey would have blown the whistle on that play if it were a regular season game. that end the grass play. That there, that was a swallow the whistle, let them play at the end of the game kind of deal, which I'm probably not okay with, but I understand how it goes that way. But that was a Super Bowl play. Jarvis Green's exactly right. That was not a regular season type of play.
No, it's an entertainment product, Andy, so let them play and let them get severely injured, because that's what America wants to see on Super Bowl Sunday. But the last thing I'll say about Eli, and throughout his career, he's been a guy, he's not a great guy in the elements, and we talk so much about, if you're going to play in Cleveland or some of these cold weather cities, you have to be sort of capable of doing it. Not that Eli doesn't have the physical traits to do it, but he's never been good in the cold weather. And the last 2 years, the Giants are actually 4-12 at home. I feel like you saw signs of it early in his career that he wasn't really great when the weather got cold and it got windy in East Rutherford and that sort of thing. So,
well, those Manning brothers don't throw a tight spiral. Peyton Manning was the same way for a lot of years. And I know someone else who coached him for a long time. They said, it was the Foxborough and his the wintry mix that we talked about a few weeks ago. And he had to struggle with that because his ball doesn't cut through the wind. They've got good arm strength, but the ball does not rotate very well coming out of their hands.
So I guess I'll pose this question to you, Andy. There's still a lot of offseason to go. There's a draft. There are a couple of veteran quarterbacks, young veteran quarterbacks, out on the market right now. Is it crazy for the Giants to go into 2019 with Eli Manning as their starting quarterback?
Let me ask you this to make sure we're on the same page. Has it been crazy that he's been the starter for these last 16, 17 years now? At any point did we think, and we're even letting hindsight do the talking, have we thought at any point the Giants should have moved on from Eli Manning?
The last 2 years is the only time I think it really became a legitimate debate.
Okay, which is the same conversation we're about to have now then, correct? So,
all right. You want to table it then? Is that what you're saying?
Do I want to table it?
Well, yeah, we'll answer it as the show goes on.
Well, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to say next year. I don't have any problem with Eli Manning being under center for the Giants. I didn't have any problem with it the last 2 years, and I don't have any problem with it now. And I imagine there's a lot to discuss there on your end then.
Yeah, well, way to blow my tease right there. You're supposed to dramatically pause and that we were going to drift into the next topic, but that's okay. We'll do that.
No, I'm done. I've made my point for the show. So if you want to talk for these next 8 minutes or so, and then we can just get out of here early, I'm fine with that.
All right, well, let's talk about the Giants rebuild in general. They're in a weird spot. They when Dave Gettleman came in last year, I think there was a feeling that they could compete. They were 1 year removed from a playoff season. They felt good about adding Saquon Barkley to Odell Beckham Jr. and Evan Engram and a pretty talented young core of skill position players. And obviously the defense wasn't good enough. The pass rush wasn't good enough. The secondary that's probably the strength of their defense, and they played a pretty mediocre brand of football. But I guess my question to you, Andy, is they've decided to do the rebuild. Odell Beckham Jr. as basically a receiver on a quarterback contract. Do you try and build around that, especially if you're potentially bringing in a rookie quarterback? And when I say bring in a rookie quarterback, I'm talking about the salary impact of that.
Yeah, I think you do if you remove the off-field stuff from the equation. If we're just talking Beckham as the player, I think you do rebuild around that. I don't think that was the conversation in New York, though. I think it got complicated because do we want to rebuild around this man, this guy, not just this player? And with Beckham, the answer turned out to be no. We kind of discussed either a week or two ago why we think that is and the merits of that. Gary, I guess I would ask you, when NFL fans want a rebuild to mean the way we do it on Madden when we play franchise mode, where let's just, because there's nothing to lose there, so we don't mind if we go 0-16. We want to get all the draft picks we can get all the cap space we can get, let the thing implode and then rebuild it from the ground up. That's really not the way it goes in the NFL. It's not the way it goes in very many sports. And I think that's where a lot of the disconnect comes from, is people expect rebuild means starting from scratch. And in the NFL, teams don't start from scratch. They rebuild from a different position. In the Giants' case, their thinking is, okay, we're going to rebuild. The best way to rebuild is to have, let's at least have a quarterback that lets everybody else function around them so we can run an offense and be in games Haskins and develop everybody else. And the best quarterback for that right now is still Eli Manning. We don't love the guy. We don't love the alternative options.
Well, let's and look, this carries over from the NBA where everyone looks at it, and if you're a 76ers fan, you're all giddy about the process because they won a playoff series last year. And, you know, in the NBA, it takes one or two players, and that's all you need, and you can completely rebuild a roster. And you know, in the NBA, essentially, you have two or three stars, and everyone else is kind of a role player, and you can completely reset that roster year after year, as, right. as you see around LeBron James constantly. In the NFL, you look at what the Browns have done over the last 3 years here, and that kind of was an NBA-style rebuild in that they lost a ton of games, and you would have thought maybe, you know, are you souring this thing? My argument continues to be, yeah, the Browns are in a good spot now. It didn't need to take that long. You don't need that much time to rebuild in the NFL. There's not that much separation in talent from team to team. If you get the right coach in and you tweak the roster a little bit, you can make a big jump. You look at what the Rams were a couple of years ago. I mean, the Falcons were a 4-12 team, and then 2 years later were in the Super Bowl. I mean, these rebuilds don't take that long in the NFL. You don't need to do a dramatic teardown and full build up.
I agree with you, and I think coaching's a huge factor that always gets overlooked in this. And we said for the last 2 years on the show, Gary, that the Browns, talent-wise, had a 5-11 type of roster, maybe 7-9 type of roster, somewhere in there. This is pre-Baker Mayfield we're talking. Mm-hmm. And they obviously they didn't win those kind of games, but the front office built the roster. So the front office didn't put out there like what the show Major League with the Twins, where they're putting out a loser on the field hoping they lose. That's not how the front office did it with the Browns. That's just the results, because the coaching staff wasn't the best fit for what they had there. And I think that's been proven with Hugh Jackson now gone and the way things went under Greg Williams and Freddie Kitchens. The Colts are another great example to add to your point of teams that can turn things around quickly. And there's another team that found the right coaching staff, Frank Reich, of one of the leading offensive minds in the league, and then Matt Eberflus, who I certainly think he was the best defensive coordinator in football last year. And that's a huge deal. I had a long conversation at the combine with someone about, if you were starting a team and you got to pick perfect conditions at either head coach or perfect with the staff being an extension of the head coach, mm-hmm. or perfect conditions at quarterback, which would you take? And we both said we'd take the head coach first, which I guess means we believe the head coach is the most important entity on the team, not the quarterback. It's a close call.
Yeah. I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
That never gets talked about when fans evaluate rebuilds. They never talk about the coaching staff, and I understand why, because how do we know who are good coaches and who are bad coaches if we're on the outside looking in?
And no one's got coaches on their fantasy football team.
Correct.
I do have to call you out for something, Andy, and this is unforgivable. Major League? It's not the Twins. It's the Indians. It's the Cleveland Indians.
What's the one where the kid appoints himself?
You're thinking of is that called Little Big League, where the kid is the owner and then he appoints himself the manager?
Yeah, that one.
Major League was the obvious
the only
pop culture.
Which is the one
there.
Where they? No, hold on. Maybe I'm mixing these up. Also, Sandlot, the one where the kid had the big long billed hat. What team did he play for? Which is the one where they said, well, I guess the only thing we can do is win the whole damn thing.
I don't remember that line, but
that's like
the
biggest line from the movie.
The plot of Major League is they're trying to intentionally lose. You were right on Major League, and then you conflated the R-rated movie with the PG-rated movie, and movie night with the kids at your house will be interesting.
Yeah, you're right. Those are two different. So I, and it's too bad, because I could have segued easily with Cleveland and said, oh, how about that baseball team from the movie, the Indians? But I, for some reason, thought they were the Twins. That kid that ran the team, though, he did run the Twins, right?
Yes, it was the Twins. I think it was a Little Big League, and he was the manager of the Twins, which was a good. That was a better movie than a lot of kids' baseball movies.
Do you think it was better than Rookie of the Year?
Yes.
And certainly you don't. Okay, I don't know if I agree with that, but we both agree Sandlot was better than all of those.
Sandlot's very good. Major League is probably better, but you can't really comp that. I mean, we're talking about, you know, this is like Dwayne Haskins versus Kyler Murray. You can't really, they're so different, you can't really comp them against each other.
They're both baseball movies for kids. I mean, hell, it's not like there's a bunch of genres under that genre.
Are you talking about Little Big League, or are you saying Major League? Major League is an R-rated movie. Like, kids can't watch Major League.
I'm saying...
There are edited versions
on Turner... at least it used to be. No, I'm saying The Sandlot is better than the one, The Little Big League. I'm saying that.
Oh, okay. That's fair. Okay. Yes, I'll go with that.
The other one I watched for the first time the other day, and then we'll get back to football. What's the one where Kevin Costner, is that Bull Durham?
Yeah.
I thought that sucked. I thought that really sucked.
Huh.
At least the first 20 minutes did, and then I stopped watching. It was on Netflix.
There was no resolution. No, I'm not going to defend that movie. I don't love that movie. I think it's a perfectly good movie. It's a little bit cliched now, but that's
what's unfair, maybe, is that at the time it wasn't clear. It was setting the trend, but it did such a good job that it became cliched when you watch it later. That's why I don't watch anything that was pre-1995, and anymore I've moved that up to about 2000.
Okay. All right. That's fair. That's fair. That would explain the confusion with the Major League and the children's movie. Getting back to how you rebuild. It was a weird offseason for the Giants because it looked like a full teardown, and then they trade Odell Beckham Jr. And we talked about this last week. If you're going to trade Odell Beckham Jr. on that contract, that's the kind of return you're going to get. You're not going to get like two high first rounders. You get a first rounder. You get a interesting young safety on a cheap contract, and you get a third rounder. I mean, that's the kind of return you're going to get. But then they go out, they sign Golden Tate, so they sort of foul up the everyone's favorite anti-labor practice, the NFL, the compensatory picks. They fouled up that, so they can't they won't pick as high, and they probably helped out a division rival with their compensatory pick calculus as well. So
interesting point, yeah. Philadelphia gets the compensatory pick for Golden Tate.
And it seems like they're just kind of stuck in between right now.
Well, so let's ask the question that has not been asked then is, are they really rebuilding, and especially in the way that we think? Because Dave Gettleman is not a young man. He is a tenured veteran. He had some health issues last year as well, so I'm sure he's viewing this as this. I would imagine he's wanting to win now. We thought that when he got hired by the Giants. He's here to win right now. Dave Gettleman's not coming aboard to start something for the next 8 years. He wants to get going. And I don't think there's anything in the last year, especially with him personally, given what he's overcome health-wise, why would his mind have changed on that? If you take out the Beckham trade, which we've already said could be as much about non-football stuff as football stuff, which makes it an outlier, if you take out that trade, then what? Name one move the Giants have done this year that clearly indicates that they are rebuilding, let alone imploding and building from the ground up.
It's a good point. They let Landon Collins walk. That was a financial decision, but
Gettleman's never paid defensive backs though either. In Carolina, he built from the front line, so I mean that could just be a philosophy move. They replaced Collins with Jabril Peppers, who's a first round pick as well, as a guy that theoretically they'll have to pay in a few years if that trade for Beckham works out the way they're hoping.
Well, and they moved Damon Harrison last year, so if we're extending it back to last season, they traded Eli Apple. I mean, they've been dipping their toe in the rebuild hot tub.
I guess so. I mean, Eli Apple kind of had the off-field football, non-football stuff as well. The Damon Harrison one's a good example. That's a very good, great point. But they also drafted B.J. Hill in the third round last year. Dalvin Tomlinson, their second-round pick from 2017, those guys have played well. And that, too, with Damon Harrison, could very well have been a cost-benefit analysis, is we've got other guys here. And, I mean, I get what you're saying, I guess. But it's to me, there's not a lot of evidence. They paid Nate Solder big money last year. They traded for Zeitler, who's not a cheap guard. I understand they got rid of Olivier Vernon for, but there's not much evidence. They drafted Saquon Barkley. You take a running back. You don't do that to play 5 years from now. You want that running back and those the tread running for you now. I don't think there's any evidence that says they are rebuilding.
Should they be?
That gets back to the Eli Manning conversation a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. They are, to me, the most fascinating team in the draft. You have two first-round picks now. If they love one of the quarterbacks, they can get whoever they want. Maybe not Kyler Murray, if indeed this Kyler Murray, Cliff Kingsbury love story is going to have the ending that everyone expects. But it's not a great quarterback class. And you ask people around the league, Kyler Murray last year would rank fifth among last year's quarterback class. And then if you are looking ahead to 2020, and that's an especially obnoxious thing to do as an NFL team, but next year's quarterback class is, there are three guys who probably would rank ahead of anyone in this year's class in Tua and Jake Fromm, and I'm forgetting one of them, but I'll look it up while you talk.
No, I want you to sit and listen to what I have to say. Do not be multitasking.
I'm listening.
I see you looking it up. Teams do look ahead like that. That's smart football. I know when Dave Caldwell, the GM for the Jaguars, interviewed for that job years ago, one of the questions asked in the interview of Dave Caldwell was, give us an example of something you learned from Thomas Dimitroff, who Caldwell worked under the previous job, a Falcons GM. What's an example of something you learned from him? And he said, I learned a lot about how you view the draft and big picture decisions and the Julio Jones trade. When Dimitroff traded up in the draft, he traded a bounty to mm-hmm. Cleveland to move up and draft Julio. I think it was number 4 overall, if I recall, somewhere around there. And part of the reason Dimitroff did that is he didn't feel that next year's draft class was nearly as strong, especially at the position they were trading up to get, as this year's draft class. So he was willing to trade his picks for next year. Teams, that's a smart way to manage the game. The coaches have to say, hey, all we're focused on is the next game. But the Thomas Dimitroffs of the world, they do have to look at the big picture. So if the Giants are much more in love with next year's QBs than this year's, that is 100% a valid reason to go about keeping Eli Manning and go about building the roster the way they have this year so far. Absolutely. You got to find the right guy. You didn't just plug in any old quarterback and think, oh, well, we'll develop him into something. He's got to be positioned to develop before you plug him in. He's got to be good enough.
Justin Herbert of Oregon, by the way, is the third guy. And
how did you say it? Oregon?
Yeah, Oregon. How do you say it?
Oregon.
Yeah?
That's how I'm west of the Mississippi would say Oregon.
I'm looking at Brandon, our producer, and he's
Brandon
he's
doesn't matter. Brandon's a New Yorker. You guys, I'm telling you.
I agree Oregon. Because he's agreeing with you. So I also I consider his opinion invalid as well, invalid as well. How about that? Justin Herbert, who plays out west, a little bit south of Washington State, he's the third guy. But he's a guy everyone did work on because everyone, as late as December, thought he would be in this year's draft, and he decided to go back and play for the Ducks again. Now I can't say that state anymore.
Yeah.
I got to go home and work on it.
You couldn't say it to begin with. That's fine.
But his brother's there, so he decided to go back. But they're familiar with that class. I'm kind of surprised that you, of all people, Andy, so I know that's a very offensive way to put it, but I'll stick with it, that you of all people are kind of down with the look ahead a year.
I think you have to do that in certain spots. If we're talking how are we spending our high first round pick, which is basically what you're talking about when you're taking a quarterback or when you're trading for the Julio Jones types, I think that's a valid way to do that kind of thing. I don't think it applies at every position, mm-hmm. but the top 1, 2, or 3 positions, I think it does apply for it. GMs do the same with their coaching staffs too, by the way. Steve Keim wanted Sean McVay when Bruce Arians retired, when Sean McVay was at the Redskins, and Steve Keim had to wait, but he was already looking at what are we going to do when Arians is gone, because they know that's how that works. You have to do that. You can't just wait and then hope that you're quick on your feet when these enormous decisions come up.
So here's my biggest worry with the Giants. Where they need to rebuild, or two of the spots that they really need to rebuild or are rebuilding, even if you consider them not rebuilding the entire roster, offensive line and secondary, those are two very chemistry-dependent spots on a football team. I think it takes more than a year to figure out what you have at those spots.
I would agree with you. And partly because those are the most reactionary spots on the field. Offensive line, what you're often talking about is pass protection. That's two-thirds of your plays are pass plays anymore. And you're reacting to the defense as a pass blocker. And then secondary, you're reacting to the offense's play design almost always. And you, when you are in a reactionary position, everyone has to be on the same page because you all have to react the same way. If you don't, that's how busts occur. So your secondary coach is a big deal, probably your most important coach other than defensive coordinator on that side of the ball. Mm-hmm. And then every coach would tell you that next to head coach, offensive line, or next to head coach and offensive coordinator, offensive line coach is the most important position coach on offense. And I bet there are a lot of coaches that would tell you that's even more important than coordinator, depending on who the head coach is. So offensive line coaches, it's interesting here. They make a lot of money. No, I don't think that gets talked about a whole lot, but they make a ton of money, and not many of them become coordinators. Once you're an offensive line coach, that tends to be what you are, because yeah, you become very valuable in that role.
The one good thing that the Giants have going for them, I mean, they've had no pass rush the last couple of years. Big time pass rush talent in this year's draft. This is the draft. If you need help up front, this is where you get it. This is the year you get it in the draft.
Well, and just to clear, by the way, in case anyone's wondering, Hal Hunter is the O-line coach for the Giants right now, and then Everett Withers, it was bugging me, so I'm looking, Everett Withers is their DB coach, and I don't know either of those guys, by the way. Now, what was the last thing you said? Because I was multitasking on you, but I guess I didn't multitask very well because I didn't listen to you.
I was going to say, you just single-task, task something else. Yeah. The pass rush. The pass rush has been non-existent the last couple of years, which is so unusual for a Giants team, but this is the draft class, and they have two first-round picks now from the Beckham trade. They have six, and they have 17. This is the draft class where you can rebuild that pass rush.
What interests me is, and we know Gettleman, we just said earlier, he builds from the front on back. So in Carolina, remember, he paid his linebackers all that money. Shaq Thompson, he drafted him even when he had Kuechly and Thomas Davis already established there. And then they've always had a rotation defensive lineman in Carolina, especially defensive tackles. So we assume that's Gettleman's philosophy, which is why he would not re-sign Landon Collins. James Betcher, their defensive coordinator, I bet if he had his druthers of how you built a defense, he'd want to do it the other way. He'd want to build from the back end, because Betcher is a blitz guy, and you don't blitz unless you're comfortable with your coverage. And Betcher did not always have, he had Chandler Jones, who's a really great player, but Betcher doesn't ask his guys in Arizona, he didn't ask them to just win off the edge one-on-one. He schemed it up for them, which we say all the time means you're not at the mercy of having great edge rushing or pass rushing talent the same way some teams are, because in theory your designs win more than individual players. But in order for all that to work, your secondary has to win. So what's interesting is James Betcher, coordinator, his philosophy, I'm guessing, and I don't know how they get along or how well they get along, but I don't think Betcher's philosophy naturally matches up to Dave Gettleman's philosophy. And what does that mean for how you build a team?
Well, I think that's been an underrated and under-discussed aspect of everything the Giants have done. We kind of look at what Gettleman's history is, and I think people kind of overlook what James Betcher has done in Arizona and it probably wants to do for the Giants here.
Absolutely. And then it raises the other discussion, well, how much do we build around James Betcher? James Betcher has head coaching aspirations, and he was a head coaching candidate, kind of a distant candidate coming out of Arizona. He interviewed for that job and almost got it over Steve Wilks. It came down to the 11th hour. And last year, the Giants didn't perform well enough for Betcher's name to surface there. But it's going to surface again in head coaching circles. So if you're the Giants and that's who our coordinator is, do we operate under the assumption that he's only going to be here 2 or 3 years? And how much do we build around exactly what he wants? We know Pat Shurmur will be here. He's our head coach, but that's an offensive guy. So how do you build your defense if you're not sure if your coordinator will be there more than 2 or 3 years? And that's just philosophy as well. Do you go out and try to find another Betcher? That's how Betcher became the coordinator. He was the understudy for Todd Bowles in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And Bowles and Betcher are very similar philosophically, because that's what Bruce Arians wanted in a D coordinator. So do the Giants have a very specific idea like Arians of what they want in a D coordinator, or where does that rank on their priorities? And I don't know the answer to that.
Well, it's going to be a fun couple of months here in New York with what the Giants do next. Last point I want to make, Andy, is with this Cleveland teardown and rebuild, everyone wants to credit Sashi Brown. Why doesn't Ray Farmer get any credit? If Ray Farmer didn't take Johnny Manziel, they don't get to position themselves at the top of the drafts all those years, and we have a whole different scenario here.
Yeah, you're wearing a wry smile, and I knew you would be for this. For one, Ray Farmer did not take Johnny Manziel. Jimmy Haslam took Johnny
Manziel. It was an ownership versus coaching staff. Coaches, maybe with a little bit of revisionist history, now say they wanted Jimmy Garoppolo. They very well probably wanted Garoppolo back then, but ownership wanted Manziel.
Ray Farmer, the point you're making is Sashi Brown should not get all this credit.
I don't think there's any.
You don't have anything against Ray Farmer. You have something against Sashi Brown.
Oh, I don't really have anything against Sashi Brown. I think in 2 years when you miss on the number of draft picks he missed on, I don't think it's an accomplishment to lose a lot of games and have a high draft pick and then turn those into more draft picks and never really land very good players with him.
No, I don't disagree with that. I don't. Now, their whole strategy was it was going to be this money ball thing, and we never did quite find out. Does that mean they're going to evaluate players that way, or does that mean they're just going to build the roster that way? But if it's roster building and the idea was to accumulate draft capital, accumulate cap space, mostly draft capital, though, if we're going by that criteria, then Sashi Brown was on the right track to accomplish his mission. Ownership just wasn't patient enough to give him a chance to let the seeds he was planting sprout into something. They fired him before, but he did follow his model, and his model did give them a lot of capital.
He did. The players they got just weren't good enough. I mean, that's what it came down to. Miles Garrett, first overall, is a good player. They passed on a lot of quarterbacks, though. They used those picks to they just didn't land very many good players over their drafts.
Well, and Sashi Brown, and I don't remember what his background is, but John Dorsey's a pure, true and true football guy. Sashi Brown, I'm guessing, has a very analytical background. It's interesting, a team set up the GM with a lot of wealth to go out and spend it, and they used a non-football guy to do it, and then they go in and bring in the pure football guy to spend the capital that the GM, previous GM, acquired.
Yeah. Interesting, I suppose. But two teams in much different spots than they were in 2 years ago here. But
so if you were rebuilding, what is your bottom line answer then? If you had Eli Manning, who I think we agree is a serviceable QB at this point, you can run your offense with Eli.
Yep.
But you're not going to – and once in a while he'll win you some games, but you never would go into say, we're going to ride Eli today. If you had that and you wanted to rebuild and you're in the Giants, but how would you go about doing that then? Are you on board? Because I believe the best way to ultimately rebuild is to win games, is to establish a winning culture and teach guys how to win and build an identity that way through the coaching staff and winning games as soon as possible.
No, I think that's absolutely fair. I don't mind what they're doing with Eli. I think it comes down to when they look at the quarterback class here, do you love any of them? And if you don't, there's no need to invest in a guy. And again, you can get away with it if you want to cut bait on a rookie quarterback after 2 years. That's not going to crush you cap-wise, but I don't have a problem with them giving Eli another year as a starter. I think you want to put some sort of plan B into motion, whether that's, maybe they're the team that gives up a second-round pick for Josh Rosen or something like that. But I don't have a big problem with it. The Beckham trade, I understand. I think it was clearly a misstep to give him the extension and then trade him the next year. But I think there's something to be said for acknowledging a mistake that you feel you made, and if they indeed consider that a mistake, might as well do something about it instead of sort of plowing forward.
Yeah, it's a great point. Don't sink with the ship. The sunk cost theory. If it'd be a mistake to not correct a mistake, and so I'm with you on how they went about with the Beckham thing. It's interesting. All these recalcitrant, temperamental wide receivers. It looked like the answer some teams that come up with is, well, let's pay them and that'll satisfy them and then we'll be fine. And it didn't go that way with Beckham so far. And there's rumblings that he still might want more money with Cleveland. And it didn't, we'll see how it goes with Antonio Brown in Oakland. But the idea of paying guys to make them happy, it raises the theory, if you have to pay them to make them happy and their difference between their performance when they're happy and when they're unhappy is so great, are they really the guy you want to be paying?
Yeah. It sounds like it's going to work out for Julio Jones again. Reports
who
are that,
goes about his business quietly, held out. He played the business side too. He dug his heels in last year, but that's different. That's different than actively being disruptive to your team, which Julio Jones has never done and I can't imagine ever would do.
Yeah, sounds like he's going to cash in again and be the highest paid receiver in football. So I don't know if there's a moral to that story. That's just something that happened now. It's good to be
the
Julio
moral of
Jones.
The story is to be 6'4", 220 and run like you're 6'1", 150.
Yeah, I should have done that instead of being 5'9 and running like I was 340 pounds.
Yeah.
All right, Andy, that's going to be a wrap for this week. We'll be back with more next week. We'll find something to deep dive, have a little bit of fun here. But as for now, thanks to our researchers, Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor, for making it sound smart. Thank you to producer Brandon Nix, his second show here with us. I don't think he knows how to pronounce states, but he's doing a nice job other than that. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. You are the best. We're going to be back with another show next week. Maybe we'll do a little mailbag, Andy. We'll see how it goes. We got a lot of mailbag questions. Piling up.
We could do mailbag. That's a good idea. And if we get an exceptionally good mailbag question, we'll just do that one, and that'll be our deep dive topic for the week.
There we go. We'll
so
hand off
send in your best stuff.
Hand off the creative work to our listenership, and that's just the way you do it in this industry. Please subscribe to all of our shows, just two right now in the offseason, but we'll be back to the four once the season kicks off. But you can get Albert Breer, Jenny Brentes, Connor Orr every Wednesday. Just subscribe to the MMQB podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio.com/10things, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. And we will see you guys next week.